This is Speaking of Faith First Person. This online exclusive is part of Repossessing Virtue, an ongoing series in which we search for fresh ways to think and talk about the current economic crisis. I'm Kate Moos, managing producer of Speaking of Faith. Here I speak with Phyllis Tickle. She is the author of many books. Recently, her title is The Great Emergence. Phyllis Tickle, to begin with, in what ways do you consider this a moral or a spiritual crisis of your own or of the culture we live in?
Well, I think that this economic upheaval that we're going through is certainly not individual in any way. We may feel the consequences of it individually, but it is part of it's part of the great emergence. It's part of what's happening in our culture and in our world. When Fareed Zakaria at Time Magazine, and now at CNN, speaks of mergenomics, what he's talking about is the fact that we're in a period of enormous globalization and enormous upheaval, not unlike what happened in the Reformation, for instance, when everything kind of got tossed up in the air and settled back down. We're going through that now. It's emergent theory or the Great Emergence. So I don't think any of us can lay individual claim to this, but having said all of that, and having said there's a historical precedent here for what we're doing, ultimately it is a moral crisis, isn't it, as well as a cultural one. That is, when you get in this kind of mess and you're standing in the middle of it and you realize the enormous capacity of greed to do in the whole human race, that there are more ways to do murder than picking up a knife and killing someone or shooting someone. That simply by acting in an irresponsible or totally greedy or undisciplined or unethical way, we now have it within our power to essentially destroy the biggest part of the world or much of the world out of sheer greed. I did a book some 4 or 5 years ago now on greed with little, I wasn't prescient in any way, Kate. I had no idea how near. And even now looking back, and I think about the research on that book, it was a part of a series on the seven deadly sins, and yes. I got lucky and got greed. But looking back on that, I'm amazed at how innocent and naive I was about the thing that I was studying, which was also right under my nose. I think if we learn anything from what we're doing right now, it's not only moral truth and religious truth, but also our incredible ability to be very naive when our bellies are full and, our homes are comfortable. Mm-hmm. And we allow greed, and we participate in greed. And one of the things that seems to me to be a moral issue right now in this crisis is our tendency, at least in this country, to turn and shake our fingers at those who have scarfed up millions and destroyed our system without realizing we participated, we enabled it. We were gambling with them. We were gambling smaller sums. Mm-hmm. But there is no guilty other here. It is we who stand, I think, guilty in front of each other.
Yeah. Now, having said that much, that greed with which we all have passing familiarity, let's say,
yes, indeed,
that greed is at the heart of it. What are the moral and spiritual resources, or what are the virtues that you now bring to approaching this problem, Phyllis, in your own life or with colleagues, your family, or other communities?
Yes, I have to. First, let me speak autobiographically, because okay. That's a very good question.
You bet.
And I'm 75, and my husband is 76. We were children of the Depression, and we have never, because of age, it's a pure fluke of age and generation. Also, we were reared in Appalachia. My father was an academic dean of State University, but it was in the very upper tip, most eastern and northern tip of Tennessee, which is still Appalachian country. So that not only were we reared very close to the realities of depression living, but we were also reared in an area that had been deprived even before the Depression, so to speak. So that our personal habits, even as a married couple, have never engaged the changes that happened after the Second World War. My husband still, for instance, saves the string that comes off of the pull on the dog food sack, if you can believe that. I have no idea what we're going to do with 2.5 million pieces of balled up string, but we're going to keep them, you know. And that's
they might have a use someday.
Might have a use someday. And that has an extravagance in a way, because now we've got drawers dedicated to pieces of string, which is stupid in a modern situation. But it's so ingrained in us, and you see where I'm going with this, it's so ingrained with us that we have not engaged in many of the things that now are flying up and hitting people in the face. So when you ask me what I'm doing privately and spiritually, nothing very different, to tell you the truth, from what we did 2 years ago. In fact, I don't know if there is any real difference. But that is to say, we've lived very conservatively. And I was charmed the other day to read a story, I think in Time, by one of their editors, maybe Newsweek, about having gone back to Appalachia to visit his parents, who are also old, and perceiving that it made very little difference. His dad still went out and chopped the wood. Mm-hmm. And Sam doesn't chop our wood, but we still live on a bit of a farmette, and the garden is ready to plant, and all the seeds are growing in the window, and we will eat.
Yes.
And so I'm aberrant that way. When I put on my other hat and become the author, the lecturer, the one bopping around the country talking about emergence and what it means both economically and otherwise, then I want to speak in terms of Islam. Islam, I think, and maybe this is one of its greater credits, Islam, more than any of the other world religions, speaks to the issue here, I think, most clearly. And it says it is a sin for anyone, it says for a man, but for anyone to have more than allows him or her to stand straight. And then it goes on, the prophet goes on to argue that if you have too much, you stand bowed from the weight of it, bowed over. If you have not enough, you're bowed over by your own need and by your own hunger and a lack of strength to stand up. And so the test of sufficiency is whether you can stand up or not. And then he argues, or the Quran argues, that if one can stand straight, then one has kept one's duty both to God and fellow man. And I like that line of thought. I think it's as clean a definition of what went wrong and what's going to fix it in terms of moral or religious terms. It certainly is not an immediately applicable economic or social definition of what needs to happen. But in the best of all possible worlds, if every one of us were to apply that principle, then we would perhaps, if not fix this one, at least prevent the next one.
Mm-hmm. Now, Phyllis, you've mentioned that you have lived with a certain, let's call it frugality or attention to...
unintentional, unstudied, yes. Mm-hmm. So ingrained. You know, I read the other day that the theory I espouse is not valid, and the theory has always been that it really wasn't until the Second World War, or halfway through the Second World War, that we began to feel any relief from the Great Depression.
Yes.
Now, I understand scholars say, no, that's not true, but from the point of view of those who lived and were cognizant during it, it was very true.
Yes.
It may be that the war was not the thing that generated the economic resurgence. I suspect it strongly was. At least more of us were employed than had been employed. And so, yes, it's a matter of if in your formative years you grow up in that attitude, that modus operandi, that understanding that to have more than you need really is to be burdened with privilege you don't want. Then you live, but it's not to be seen as any kind of moral goodness on my part.
Exactly.
It's a generational thing.
Understood. Tell me, is there any way in which you are living differently now, even a small way, that is different because of the crisis, or are you seeing your world differently, or even in the grocery store, making a different choice as a result?
Well, we have, interestingly enough, and I think we would have done this anyway, Kate, we have gone down to one car, and that simply, I think, it was a reflection, and we did it about within the last 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
one of our children needed a new car, and we just said, don't buy one, take this one. I think it would have happened anyway. It's an acknowledgement that I'm not home a great deal now, that I'm on the road most of the time, mm-hmm. and that we can do with one car. But we certainly have dropped to one car. The second thing is the car we kept has had two major illnesses in the last 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
And each time we have elected to fix the illness instead of go buy. I suspect, I can't prove it, I suspect had that happened 15, 18 months ago, we'd have just bought a new car,
sure.
Instead of patching this one. So I think that there is some sense of cutting back.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike many older folk, we're not yet on a fixed income because I'm still working.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the option to fix the thing. But I think we elected not to, probably on the basis of the times. I don't do the shopping in our home anymore. My husband is now a retired physician and has always loved to cook and loved to shop because it was his recreation when he was practicing. And so he does those now. But I get ongoing reports about the fact of something he didn't buy because he thought it would come down, or something he didn't buy because he knew a store where it was now cheaper. I'm very aware that I get, when I am home, a sort of daily price report from the market,
mm-hmm.
and that he's tracking it rather carefully. Whether he would have done that before this, I don't know, because he's just now retired enough to be able to do all of this, and so it's almost a new toy for him.
Okay. Phyllis, here's the final question. It's a big one, though. What kind of wisdom and leadership do you look for now? Close to home, where are you finding it? Are there new voices or different voices that you're aware of?
Yes. Obviously, and I'm sure each of your respondents has said this, in Mr. Obama, I find not a president, but the spirit of everything that is good in this country, of everything we have fought for and our forebears dreamed could happen in a polity. As he struggles, the first thing I do is pray consistently and daily for whatever wisdom there is out there and whatever shrewdness and whatever political savvy there is out there. To accrue to him and to his decisions. So I find consolation in our collective wisdom as a people in having made our commitment to Obama, to Mr. Obama, and to what he stands for. That idealism having been expressed, I hope that we are correct in saying that the Secretary of the Treasury now seems to me a man who's very gifted in what he's doing. Wisdom also in history.
Mm-hmm.
We've been here before, and I'm
yes.
back where I was when we started this interview. About every 500 years, Western society or First World society or that society colonized by the First World throws everything up in the air, and it all sort of goes to hell in a handbasket, if you will. And we did it 500 years ago, we did it 1,000 years ago, we did it 1,500 years ago when Rome fell, we did it 2,000 years ago. So we're doing that which has happened before. And when one of these things happens, it affects not only religion, obviously the Reformation gave us Protestantism, but it affects all of the economics of the society in which, of Western society, of First World society. It affects the sociology, the intellectuality. All of it is deeply affected. And what we're seeing right now is but one part of emergence. What we're seeing right now, as Zakara says, is emergenomics. We're seeing the economic presentation of it in the same way that we're seeing the religious upheaval that's part of going through this period of transition. And sociologically, everything is changing. We're addicted now to information. All of those things are an indication we're going through one of these 500-year rummage sales or whatever. And I think history, more than anything else, offers me consolation and offers me a sense of perspective. But having said that, let me also say, you know and I know, at 75, I'm going to be out of here soon, so I can afford that kind of cavalier or cavalier-sounding calm way. I don't think there's any huge reason to not look at history and say, as a community, we will survive.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it would be very, very wrong, I think, to not say, but many of us are going to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And so lastly, I take consolation in the fact that we live in a country which is close to something like the beloved community, where we have in place both faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and a government informed by the Judeo-Christian or Abrahamic tradition that's going to reach out and minimize the pain, the agony for many of us as individuals, as we as a family and a group and a community go through to whatever comes next. We will survive. We've always survived. It's to minimize our individual losses that I think burdens each of us as voters and as members of faith, or I would hope so anyway.
You've been listening to Phyllis Tickle. She's the author of many books, most recently, The Great Emergence. This is Repossessing Virtue, speaking of faith's continuing exploration of the economic crisis. For more, subscribe to the SOF podcast and visit speakingoffaith.org.